Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 67, Psychology and Kabbalah, December 19, 2006.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast, hosted by everyone's favorite psychologist, Dr. David Van Nuys. We're coming to you from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
The Hebrew term, or the Kabbalistic term for meditation, is hit bodedut, which means spiritual isolation, which is a beautiful way of articulating the meditative experience of cutting yourself off from everything else and getting into yourself. This practice of hit bodedut, of meditation, is as old as the Jewish spiritual experience.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Abner Weiss, author, psychologist, and rabbi. Rabbi Weiss is the author of the 2005 book, Connecting to God, Ancient Kabbalah and Modern Psychology. Rabbi Weiss is a clinical member of the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapists and a member of the American Psychological Association. He was senior rabbi of Durban, South Africa, the Riverdale Jewish Center in New York, Beth Jacob Congregation of Beverly Hills, and the Western Marble Arch Synagogue in London. He has held professorships in Jewish thought at the University of Natal, Yeshiva University, and London University, and has served as chief judge of the Rabbinical Court, Beth Din, of Los Angeles, president of the Board of Rabbis of Southern California, and Vice President of the Rabbinical Council of America. Rabbi Weiss has studied Kabbalah since 1965 and has given lectures on it in North America, South America, Australia, and England. In 1999, he earned a Ph.D. in psychology from the Saybrook Graduate School in San Francisco. He lives in Los Angeles and is rabbi of the Westwood Village Synagogue and co-president of Village Mental Health Associates. Now, here's the interview. Rabbi Abner Weiss, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've been reading and enjoying your book, Connecting to God, which is about psychology and Kabbalah. In it, you share your own personal story about growing up in Johannesburg, South Africa, and how you came first to be a rabbi and then later to Kabbalah, and then subsequently to psychology. Perhaps you can take us through that.
Yes, surely. When I was an undergraduate at the University of the Witwatersrand in the 50s, a long time ago, I was enamored with psychology. And I remember my first class, as a freshman, it was a very, very tall lecturer. His name was Wolfenius, who walked into the lecture hall. There were about 600 students, all eager to learn about psychology. And he said that he would like to disabuse his students of three things. There is no God, there is no soul, and there is no mind.
What a wonderful beginning.
What a wonderful beginning. So I was spiritually oriented and very disappointed. The school at that time, and it had an excellent program. Walpi was there. Fritz Perls was practicing in Johannesburg at the time. But that school was either doctrinaire Freudian analysis, and Freud had called himself the personal enemy of God, or it was a very rigid behaviorism. So after 3 years of that psychology, I had decided that it doesn't fit my soul.
Mm-hmm.
And that if I was going to help people and bring them spiritual healing, I would do that through the rabbinate. So I left psychology. I'd done a full training. In those days, the bachelor was 3 years, and that meant at least 3 sessions a day in the morning and 2 full, either labs or clinic, afternoons a week. It was very intensive.
Yes, it sounds like it.
We even had patients, you know, under supervision in the child guidance clinic. And it was a very good training, but it was very off-putting if you had any kind of spiritual orientation.
Yes, I can understand.
And I went into rabbinical school also looking for spiritual inspiration, and frankly, that was also disappointing. I learned the skills, I learned how to handle the texts, but there were no courses on the Jewish mystic tradition. And one of the teachers at the seminary in Israel happened to mention almost en passant that it was impossible to understand a certain biblical passage without a belief in reincarnation, as in the Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm.
So I met him afterwards and I said, I'd like to know more. And he pointed me to a medieval author who wrote in the idiom of philosophy, but who was a Kabbalistic master, and that was the great Rabbi Loew of Prague. And I fell in love with Rabbi Loew's writings, and that was my segue to Kabbalah. I got a PhD in philosophy at Yeshiva University, which was just about the only place where I could find people who could understand those texts. And I continued to study Kabbalah, but not to teach it, because it was not fashionable at the time. It was still a very rationalist period.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 80s, I noticed that there had been a paradigm shift, both in psychology and in religious thought. In psychology, suddenly spirituality, as you recall in the 80s, became a catchphrase. Almost every new popular title on psychology had the word spirituality in it.
Yes, let me just interrupt you there, because in your book you talk about what you call the failure of the psychological revolution, and I'm wondering what were you referring to there when you talked about the failure of the psychological revolution?
Clearly, the 20th century, and especially the second half of the 20th century, was the age of psychology. There was a surfeit of theoretical positions. People like Corsini were producing books on different modalities of psychotherapy. Psychotropic medication had come into its own. People were prescribing for all kinds of things and promising a kind of psychological nirvana. Depression could be handled with pills or with pills and cognitive therapy. There were solutions which were promised to all kinds of things which would give people happiness and fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And yet clearly people were not happy. And they were looking mainly to the East to find meaning in their lives. And people like Ken Wilber became very popular and very influential. It was quite clear that psychology hadn't delivered because it had ignored this very important spiritual component of the human experience.
But then it began to come around. You began to find a version of psychology, you said, that you were able to...
That incorporated, yes. The transpersonal psychologists began to write, you know, very convincingly. Jung suddenly enjoyed a renaissance, if you recall from that period.
Yes.
People started reading Assagioli again.
Mm-hmm.
When I was an undergraduate, you know, he was a historical figure. He wasn't real.
Right.
Frankl became awfully important. I remember Maslow's first book, He wrote it with a guy called Mittleman, and it was called The Principles of Abnormal Psychology. Do you remember?
No, I don't remember that one.
It was in the 50s. It was a textbook.
Okay.
And suddenly, Maslow was the guy who spoke about the hierarchy of needs, with spiritual needs at the top of the pyramid.
Yes, and that's been a very enduring model as well.
That's right. So this is what I call the psychological revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to happen almost at once in the 80s. And at the same time, Kabbalah suddenly burst into the open as well.
Yeah, so what do you see as the relationship between psychology and Kabbalah?
Well, this was almost accidental in terms of my own journey. I'd been studying Kabbalah. I had returned to psychology and gotten myself a master's and subsequently enrolled in a PhD program. And I began to notice a complete psychological theory in this vast Kabbalistic literature, which combined many elements which today we take for granted as clinical strategies with spiritual interventions like meditations and so on. And it seemed to me that that here we had a way of looking at human behavior and human relationships not only in terms of psychological influences, but also spiritual potentials.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is how I came to write the book.
Yes, and this also, in some ways, sounds reminiscent of Carl Jung. Do you see a relationship between Kabbalah and Jungian thought?
Yes. And people have begun to write about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know, you know, how much of the Kabbalistic literature Jung knew. What's clear to me is that truths are universal.
Indeed.
So I think, you know, when Jung spoke about the archetypes, you know, which is fundamental to the Jungian model, in the Kabbalah, I didn't even write about this in my book because this is very complex mystical thinking. The different aspects of divinity are also articulated in terms of these figures, the supernal mother, the supernal father, so that there is a whole archetypal model in the Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you have a chapter, I think, called The Essence of Kabbalah. Are you able to characterize that briefly? What do you see as the essence of Kabbalah?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. I think that the essence of Kabbalah is conveyed in two biblical stories. The first is the story of Moses' first encounter with the divine at the burning bush, when the divine says to him, "Go to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go." And Moses, who's had no religious background, no religious upbringing, no religious education, says to him, "When he asks me, 'Who is this God who sent you? What is his name? What shall I say?' And the divine answers very mysteriously by saying, 'Eheyeh asher eheyeh,' which literally means, 'I am, sent me.' Or, more correctly, the Hebrew word, the Hebrew root of eheyeh, is havaya, which is being, B-E-I-N-G.
Mm-hmm.
So the divine defines itself as being, as it were, with a capital B.
Mm-hmm.
And the implication of that is that anything that has being obviously partakes of the divine. You remove the divine from the human being, for example, and it stops being. It ceases to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second story is the story of the creation of Adam in the second chapter of Genesis. And of course, the stories are not to be taken literally. we're told that God fashions a humanoid form from the earth and breathes into its nostrils the breath of life, and it becomes a living soul. The sages of the Kabbalah say that one who breathes of one's own vitality, which means, and the image here is of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, that a lifeless being suddenly becomes vitalized, vivified, by getting the life force of another being. So what the biblical image is there is that this humanoid form becomes a human being with a lowercase b when it is infused by being, which is the uppercase b, the supernal being. So the question is, how does this enormous energy confine itself to a burning bush? Mm-hmm. How is it possible that infinite being is able to enter into the very vulnerable, small human frame? And what I do in that chapter is propose almost a parable, a metaphor, if you will. Imagine a city which is powered by a nuclear reactor. Now, we know what the force and the power of that reactor is. Anybody who approaches the core becomes not pulverized, but annihilated, mm-hmm. because nothing can coexist with that kind of energy. We saw what happened at Hiroshima, which was a very small nuclear force. We saw what happened when Chernobyl began to leak.
Yes.
So how is it possible that your light switch can be powered by this nuclear reactor? The nuclear power is transformed and it's filtered as it moves along the grid. And that is exactly how the Kabbalah asks us to imagine the infinite divine energy transformed through a series mm-hmm. of transformers or power centers, which are cosmic, which are called the Sephirot, literally the divine spheres or divine energy centers.
Aha, uh-huh. Yes, I've encountered that word in the book, and I'm glad to hear you refer to it.
Right, and because this is the way in which the divine works through everything that has being, through the entire cosmos, it's the way in which the divine powers the human being as well. So that if we can identify those energy centers, as it were, and get them working correctly, then we can achieve healthy psycho-spiritual functioning.
Now, when you say energy centers, this, of course, brings to mind chakras. Does this in any way?
Very, very close to the chakra system.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very close. In fact, some of the Eastern masters, there's a fellow called Master Cho, who has a very large following in California, has actually produced books in which the chakras are superimposed on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, which is the Sphira system. So very, very close.
Okay.
And again, that's what the universality of truth is.
Yes. Now, when and where did the Kabbalah originate? I assume it's a writing or a collection of writings?
It is a collection of writings. It was originally an oral interpretation of the five books of Moses, going back very, very far in time. It's probably as old as the Revelation itself. But because it was meant to be an oral tradition, and the difference between a written tradition and an oral tradition is that the written tradition tends to be carved in stone. The oral tradition goes on developing mm-hmm. and grows with the input of inspired individuals in every period. But unfortunately, the way in which you can destroy an oral tradition is by killing the teachers. And there was a period of persecution when the Romans grew tired of this restless Jewish community in ancient Judea and started killing the teachers. It was at that time that some of the Kabbalistic teachings were reduced to writing so that they wouldn't be lost. And this was a process which continued and grew until finally the Zohar got its final form in the 1300s in Spain by Moses de Leon. And the literature continued to grow and still grows today. So it's a vast written literature now. Very difficult because most of it is written in Aramaic. Mm-hmm. And in a difficult Aramaic.
And you had to study Aramaic to understand it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you mentioned the 1300s, that this was a period of flowering for Kabbalah?
This was a period of flowering, but also there were intimations that bad stuff was going to follow and that it was important to write the stuff down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And wasn't that about the same time of alchemy? I'm wondering again if there was any relation.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Coming back, this is, again, very, very interesting. Coming back to the master about whom I wrote for my first PhD, the great Rabbi Lo of Prague, he flourished in Prague in the 16th century. There was enormous interest. This was the time of the Renaissance. There was enormous interest in alchemy at that time. The Emperor Rudolf had actually moved the seat of the Habsburg Empire to Prague. And he did the unheard-of thing. He invited this Rabbi Lo on two occasions for private audiences because he believed that anybody who had access to the mysteries of the Bible could teach him how to transmute base metals into gold. So alchemy was very much in the air.
Okay.
This is reminiscent again of a theme in Jungian writing.
Yes.
And this is the image of the alchemist.
Right, right. You referred earlier to reincarnation, and when I was looking at the book, I was quite surprised to see that a belief in reincarnation is associated with Kabbalah. How is that? And do you think there may have been any early contact between Kabbalists and Buddhists?
Well, let me take the first part of the question first.
Okay.
From its very beginnings, the Kabbalah takes it for granted. It's a Kabbalistic doctrine that the human soul has more than one shot at achieving perfection, and that it requires many journeys in many bodies, the soul does, in order to perfect itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not quite the same as karma, for example. Karma is simply a universal cosmic law of cause and effect. What you cause to be done, you have to undo if you've caused something bad to be done. In Kabbalah, the purpose of reincarnation is that and also what the sages call tikkun, which is growth, which is fulfillment, which is perfection. So you not only have to put right what you've done wrong, but you also have further opportunities for spiritual and psychological growth towards healing and ultimately towards wholeness. So that's the doctrine of reincarnation, and it's an absolute given in Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm.
One of the treatises of the Kabbalistic classic, which is called The Tree of Life by Isaac Luria, who is at the center of the tradition, is the treatise on the resurrection of souls. So this is a fundamental doctrine of Kabbalah. Is there any connection between this doctrine and the Eastern doctrines of reincarnation? Again, truth is universal. Whether or not there were contacts between the teachers and the masters, I don't know. It could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Jews were merchants who did travel to the Far East. They developed the spice routes and the silk trade to Europe.
Yes, yes.
So there certainly could have been that contact, but my hunch is that these were truths which were separately intuited by masters at different times.
Mm-hmm. Can you comment on the role of meditation in relation to Kabbalah?
Yes, indeed. The Hebrew term, or the Kabbalistic term for meditation, is hit-bodedut, which means spiritual isolation, which is a beautiful way of articulating the meditative experience of cutting yourself off from everything else and getting into yourself. This practice of hit-bodedut, of meditation, is as old as the Jewish spiritual experience. The Talmud tells us that the ancient pious ones used to meditate for an hour before they indulged in public worship. So before there was fixed prayer, there was the spontaneous meditative experience, the meditative connection. There were different techniques for meditation. Also, some of them paralleled in the Eastern traditions. One of the techniques is mantra meditation.
Yes.
And that is the repetition of words or phrases. Now, obviously, the mantras are based on Hebrew words or phrases. The most powerful ones are different names of the divine, in the same way as Om in the Eastern tradition is a very powerful mantra, and incidentally, that is one of the 70 names of God in the Kabbalistic tradition.
Interesting. Interesting.
So that was one mode of meditation, of excluding the outside world, as it were, and entering into oneself. Another mode was to focus on the shape of different letters and to combine these letters. And, of course, the most powerful letter meditations took the different Hebrew names of the divine and interwove them and moved them virtually, as it were, through visualization, through the different spherot that I've described.
Mm-hmm.
Very powerful meditations. Those are probably infinitely more powerful than the mantra meditations.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's just being still, you know, focusing on your breath. There's a neshama meditations, because the Hebrew word for breath, neshima, and for soul, derive from the same root. So there's a very old and a very highly developed meditative tradition, and I found that it's a very useful tool in my clinical practice. I'm able to calm people. I'm able to use their inner resources to deal with fears, to overcome phobias.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very powerful.
Yes, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. How has your study of Kabbalah impacted your practice as a counselor and therapist?
When I began to recognize that there was a psychological theory and a therapeutic strategies inherent in the Kabbalistic tradition, I decided to test these things clinically by offering a series of workshops with the late Harry Jacobs, who was also a trained, you know, who had been trained in psychology, who had a PhD. And we advertised these workshops primarily in Los Angeles, and people volunteered to come and participate, and they spent 3 days with us in group sessions, you know, using some of the things that strategies that I believed might be helpful clinically.
Mm-hmm.
And the results were quite startling to me. Some of them said that they had immediate relief. Well, immediate relief, if you've been working for 3 days, is not so immediate. It's lots of hours. Others were open to continuing with serious individual therapy or beginning individual therapy. But in almost every case, these workshops had produced some kind of psychological breakthrough for the participants. This encouraged me to gradually begin to introduce some of the strategies which I had tried in the workshops into my own clinical practice. Of course, with the permission of the clients, because they were really new, they hadn't been written up, and again the results were very, very encouraging. And among these strategies were meditations, especially guided meditations, in eliminating different phobias, and some of the techniques of the Kabbalah in dealing with the problem of letting go. People are often stuck in their past angers and in their past relationships.
Yes.
Because they're unable to forgive. Forgiveness is very difficult.
Yes.
When you feel that you've been wronged. And as long as you don't forgive, you really are stuck in relationships which have long ago been toxic and paralyzing. So we used different Kabbalistic modes of for achieving forgiveness. Now, in my studies, I found a little Kabbalistic classic which was translated into English, unfortunately a very literalist translation and very heavy. The English is called the Palm Tree of Deborah, which really is a small psychotherapeutic gem, suggesting different interventions, literally interventions, for where you are stuck in different aspects of your experience. You may be stuck cognitively, you may be stuck emotionally, you may be stuck in relationships.
Interesting. And when would that book have been written?
That book was written in the 16th century.
My goodness.
Quite remarkable. And what I then finally, when I wrote this book, and I'll tell you what the catalyst for writing the book was.
For writing your book.
Yes, I'd been asked to give a talk in Aspen, Colorado, and it was very well attended. I called it Ancient Kabbalah and Modern Psychology. That was one of the roots of the title of the book. And I spoke for a long time, and during the question and answer time, somebody put up his hand, and he said that he is a psychologist in practice in Texas. I think it was in Dallas. He gave me his card and said that he had been wrestling with a case where his patient had been stuck, and he had been stuck therapeutically for a long time. And while I was speaking, he got an aha, you know, a moment of insight.
Marvelous.
And he said, why don't you turn this into a book? And I said, yeah, yeah, and how am I going to make a living while I do that? So somebody else who was at the lecture called me in Los Angeles and said he would like that book to be written. So this person asked me to meet him in Los Angeles, and he said, what will it take? And I said, I would need to have some kind of financial support if I take time off from my practice. And he said, tell me how much. And I found out what it would cost, you know, how much I would be losing, roughly.
Yeah.
And I contacted him, and he said, okay, he will sponsor it.
My goodness, you are a fortunate author indeed.
That was very, very lucky. It doesn't happen very often.
No, no, not in these times.
Right, and then Random House picked it up and ran with it. That's one of their labels.
Yeah, that's great. Well, to kind of begin to wind things down, in your book, you noted that there's been an explosion of books on Kabbalah since 2001, and also we're hearing of various celebrities being attracted to it, people such as Madonna, Barbara Streisand, Demi Moore, Roseanne Barr. Why all of this interest all of a sudden, do you think?
I think for two reasons. The first is the failure of the contemporary world to provide a sense of meaning and purpose. I spoke about the failure of the psychological revolution a little earlier. There was also the failure of a world in which things have been made much easier for us. We have gadgets for just about everything, and yet there is a restlessness. I think there was also a failure of the established religions to grasp the need for going inward. Institutionalized religion tended, for the most part, to be precisely institutionalized.
Yes.
It expressed itself legitimately in social action, but didn't understand the need that people felt for an inner connection. And this need was served, I think, by the mystic tendencies in the different religions. Mm-hmm. For example, Sufism became quite popular, and that's Muslim mysticism.
Right.
There was an explosion of interest in Eastern mysticism in the United States.
Yes.
Starting with Yogananda's work, wonderful work.
Mm-hmm.
The explosion of Buddhist writings, and Ken Wilber belongs to that genre, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But what was so attractive about Kabbalah to so many people was that it was firmly rooted in the Western spiritual tradition, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, so that the terms and the language were accessible and were known, and yet it provided a path to inwardness and also to psycho-spiritual healing. So that, I think, accounts for it.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much, Rabbi Weiss, for sharing yourself with us today.
You're more than welcome. I hope that your listeners will enjoy it and will enjoy the book.
I'm sure they will, and I'll put a link to the book on my website.
Thank you so much, David, and thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Rabbi Abner Weiss. I always like to add some commentary of my own after these interviews. I'm finding this particular interview challenging to comment on since I know so little about Kabbalah. And I notice Rabbi Weiss pronounced it both Kabbalah and Kabbalah, and so I may vary in my pronunciation since I have always called it Kabbalah. After the interview, I found myself thinking about Europe during the Middle Ages and wondering about the possible interconnections of various events during that period. I believe Rabbi Weiss said that although Kabbalah has much earlier roots, it reached its fullest flowering in the 1200s. This set me to wondering about alchemy, which was another mystical tradition that I believe was flourishing at about that same time, although it too has earlier roots. And you may recall that I asked him in the interview about alchemy, and he confirmed that there are parallels. I'm also wondering about the Crusades and how they might have figured into this whole mix. The Crusades ran from 1095 until 1291. With European Crusaders traveling to the East, my guess is that they may have picked up ideas and artifacts that were brought back to Europe and that may have helped to feed European mysticism. I'm also wondering if the dangerous times with Crusaders about wouldn't have helped to drive non-Christian ideas underground, to have given impetus to secret societies and coded esoteric knowledge. I found some confirmation for this on a website named JewishHistory.org, where they write, and I quote, "As persecutions increased in the wake of the Crusades, people began searching for a deeper meaning of existence to help them understand the harshness of life around them. One of the basic beliefs of Kabbalah is that in addition to leading a righteous life, one may also contemplate mystic traditions which can bring one closer to God. There are two kinds of Kabbalah, theoretical, which is more speculative and epistemological, and practical, which is more mystical and magical, using amulets and the various names of God," end quote. Add to this mix the Inquisition, which also overlaps this period. During the Inquisition, anything that deviated from the Roman Church policy was regarded as heresy and was seriously punished. I'm speculating that the persecution of heretics during the Inquisition would have further accelerated the process of coding and making secret certain non-Christian ideas. Then along come the 1300s with the plague, the Black Death, and with that comes onto the scene and kills an estimated one-third of Europe's population. In many places, Jews are blamed. According to Wikipedia, quotes, "As with other natural and man-made social disasters, renewed religious fervor and fanaticism bloomed in the wake of Black Death. In many parts of Europe, rumors circulated that Jews caused the plague by deliberately poisoning wells. Fierce pogroms frequently resulted in the death or banishment of most of the Jews in a town or city. By 1351, 60 major and 150 smaller Jewish communities had been exterminated, and more than 350 separate massacres had occurred. This persecution was often done not solely out of religious hatred, but as a way of attacking the kings or church who normally protected the Jews. Indeed, Jews were often called the king's property. It was a way of lashing out at the institutions who had failed them. Because fewer Jews died from the Black Death, in part due to rabbinical law, which called for a lifestyle that was in general cleaner than that of a medieval villager, and Jewish ghettos, which kept them more separate from the general population, inevitably Jews looked suspicious. This, coupled with the fact that the elite members of the Jewish community, such as rabbis and bankers, were participating in a mystical religion known as the Kabbalah, placed notable blame on Jews. An important legacy of the Black Death was to cause the eastward movement of what was left of North European Jewry to Poland and Russia, where it remained until the 20th century. End quote. Next, my meandering associations led me to wonder about the Tarot, and my suspicion that it is probably also tangled up in all these preceding events. The first known Tarot decks emerge in the 1400s. At some point, the decks evolve in a direction that draws from such sources as alchemy, astrology, and Kabbalah to encode what might be referred to as the perennial mystical wisdom of the ages. There is a diagram that plays a prominent role in Kabbalah. You can find it in Rabbi Weiss's book and also on the web. It's known as the Tree of Life, and it depicts 10 spheres or nodes with 22 paths that connect the nodes. The nodes are called Sephirot, and they are associated with the names of God, with the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and with certain qualities such as wisdom, understanding, mercy, justice, beauty, and so on. Now, without going into the Tarot too deeply, it's interesting to note that the deck is divided into two parts. The first part of the Tarot is known as the Major Arcana and consists of a group of 22 cards, which are generally thought to relate to the deepest spiritual truths along our soul's journey. So, it has been suggested that the 22 cards of the higher arcana correspond to the 22 paths between the spiritual qualities denoted by the 10 sephirot in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. The remaining 56 cards of the Tarot, referred to as the minor arcana, have a rough correspondence to our traditional playing cards. Some Tarot scholars suggest that the 10 numbered cards of each of the four suits are aspects of the 10 sephirot of the Tree of Life. Well, at this point I'm getting out of my depth. You can dig up more on the topic if you're interested by doing a Google search on Kabbalah and Tarot. Kabbalah being spelled K-A-B-B-A-L-A-H, and Tarot, T-A-R-O-T. I've had a long interest in the Tarot, and I have a psychologist friend who's actually written an excellent book on psychology and Tarot. He and I both approach the Tarot from a Jungian point of view, seeing it as a sort of laboratory for exploring and inviting in the interplay between symbols and synchronicity. This reminds me to invite him onto the show sometime soon.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
We're happy to be sponsored by Podshow and GoDaddy. Use the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout And you can buy a domain name for a whole year at GoDaddy.com for just $6.95 instead of the usual $8.95. Christmas is almost here, and buying a vanity domain name for friends or family can make for a unique and surprising gift. And don't forget, you can now purchase the first 50 shrink wrap radio shows on two MP3 CDs for a fairly nominal price. Just go to www.poddisc.com, that's PODDISC.com, and you'll also find a link to the site on the left side of the page at shrinkwrapradio.com. It might be easier to buy those two CDs than to download 50 shows. Thanks to all who've taken our listener survey. If you haven't filled it out yet, please do so. You'll find it at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm, and also there's a link at shrinkwrapradio.com. And if you include your name and email address, you'll get a little surprise in return. Now, we have four new additions to our Frapper map, and I want to give a big thank you and welcome to our community to Shana in Boise, Idaho. And I recognize Shana as another podcaster who has the mindandbodycast.com. You might want to check that out. Lucretia in North Glen, Colorado, welcome. Rabiakiva, I hope I'm saying that right, in Tel Aviv, Israel. And Tanja in Oslo, Norway. Now, to add yourself to our growing Frapper map, all you have to do is go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. Or, once again, you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Plus, you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book I co-authored, and I need to do that drawing real soon now. I was keeping track of the total number of pins on our Frapper map, but I've discovered that for some strange reason, their counter stops counting at 264, at 264. So it stopped a few shows ago, and I know we've got more than 264 pins, but let's not stop until we have total world domination. Also, there's still lots of countries not heard from yet. So even though I can't count the pins, or at least they're not counted for me automatically, I can still track the names. So it's still the names and the location. So it's still worth your doing.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio, shrinkwrapradio.com.
Every now and then, I like to play that comment by Adam Curry, the founder of Pod Show. But I guess it's a little bit like preaching to the choir since you're already a listener. Adam's plug is a good reminder that it's time to dip into the wonderful emails you've been sending. Our first is from Mark in Pennsylvania, who previously left a voice message. He writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. Thank you for letting me leave a message on your Skype voicemail." And we had also had a little chat because the first time he tried to leave the voice message, I picked up, which he wasn't expecting. He says, as I explained in our telephone call, I am currently retired and have been listening to your podcasts on a, quotes, casual basis. That is to say, I've been able to pick up and choose what I listen to when I want to listen to it. I presently have a MS, that'd be Master of Science, in Psychology from Shippensburg University of Pennsylvania. This is not a counseling degree, and it does not qualify me to do anything other than experiments. However, I've always been interested in psychology. I might say that I began studying psychology as a substitute for therapy. You wouldn't be the first to do that, Mark. The study of psychology has given me an opportunity to understand the process of aging, my relationship with my parents, etc. During the course of my studies, I had the opportunity to take a course with Judith Palatina. I don't know if it's Palatina or Palatinia. PhD, whose field is legal psychology. Dr. Palatinia, that's how I'm going to say it, is also one of those jury consultants. In fact, she had worked on the Timothy McVeigh case as a consultant. I became interested in the work of jury consultants when the O.J. Simpson case became the main interest in the news media. I enjoyed listening to Joelle and Demetrius, Ph.D., and other people talk about jury selection. All of this preceded my taking the course with Dr. Palatania. Would there be any interest in a podcast on jury consultants? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, there would be. I tried to break into that field myself a few years ago, unsuccessfully. So I'll be very interested in talking to Dr. Palatania. And in fact, I've lined her up for the very next show. Mark goes on to write, Dr. Palatania is presently at Roger Williams University in Rhode Island, but I'm sure there are other jury consultants you may already know. In fact, you may already know Joelle and Demetrius. Actually, I don't, Mark. But thank you very much for the suggestion of Dr. Palatina, Mark, and I'm really looking forward to her interview. I've enjoyed a lively exchange with faithful listener Lloyd in Australia, who writes, Hiya, I too shared your misgivings about Randy Gage in episode number 63. I mean, if poverty is a sin, doesn't that make Jesus an extreme sinner? The real sin is living in excess like Randy does with his however many cars. We don't live in a world of infinite resources like he seems to think, and while the resources are so disproportionately allocated, that kind of excess is wrong. There's nothing wrong with buying a nice car. There is something wrong with buying five. Best regards, Lloyd. I also heard from longtime listener David in Manila, who wrote to recommend Dr. Albert Bandura as a guest for the show. Now, Albert Bandura is a very famous Stanford professor, famous for his work in learning theory. I don't know if I'll be able to get him or not, but that's a wonderful suggestion. And I also recall that David in Manila really liked what Randy Gage had to say. So, you know, takes all kinds. In another email, Lloyd wrote again to comment on the interview with Dr. David Sinclair on addiction. He writes, Hi again, episode 64 on addiction held particular interest for me. I have, over the past 3 years, attempted to systematically give up my addictions. I identified my main addictions, as in patterns of behavior I do habitually, as alcohol, cannabis, tobacco, pornography, soft drink, and coffee. None of these were major addictions, but just normal everyday usage. Nonetheless, the journey has been far harder than I could ever have imagined. I have been able to do, but with some it took over 50 attempts, without exaggeration. It really hit home to me how ingrained these patterns are, even at moderate usage. It has been most worthwhile, the effort of freeing myself from such things. The main benefit is clear-headedness, which I value highly. Best regards, Lloyd. Well, Lloyd, good for you. I can tell you're a very conscientious person, and you hold yourself to a high standard. Well, I think I'll wrap up today's email with a nice long one that I got from listener Jeff, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, congratulations on your ongoing success. You are racking up an impressive amount of shows, both in quantity and quality. For contextual purposes, this is my second missive to you. Last summer, I wrote to you about my practice of non-mutually exclusive religious beliefs, omnitheism. I was gratified by your kind response. And yes, Jeff, I do remember that exchange. Since then, I've listened to a number of shows and feel compelled to write again. First, I was all prepared to be rather defensive about what Mr. Gage, that's Randy Gage again, had to say in show number 62. Randy, however, was quite disarming, and I was won over by his sincerity. I have spent a considerable portion of my career in sales, and I have seen positive thinking utilized to push people well beyond their comfort zones for the sole purpose of corporate interests. Needless to say, such misappropriations of this type of psychology are quite unappealing. Like yourself, I was sympathetic, to a limited degree, with the person who wrote in, identifying with Nietzsche. I agree that pretending the struggle can be circumnavigated or eliminated is a dangerous notion. Recently, I've come across two interesting books that respectively touch on the virtues of positive thinking and remarkably enough, negative thinking. Allow me to present a brief summary of both. The Luck Factor by Richard Wiseman. The Luck Factor is a pop psychology book, but one with a fair amount of credibility relative to other pop psychology books. The author tackles the concept of luck and breaks down the behavioral characteristics that allegedly lucky people have. Among many things, he looks at how lucky people use creative imagery to imagine how a hazardous event could have been worse, thus converting the negative occurrence into a positive one. Unlike most pop psychology books, the author does not shy away from using statistics, experimental findings, and charts to make his points. Richard is a professor of psychology at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK. I like the book, and my wife does as well, but it goes a bit overboard in asserting what positive thinking can accomplish. Possible interview candidate? Yes, definitely. I should try to track him down. Although I must say the list of possible interview candidates continues to outpace what I can actually produce, even though I'm producing a lot. He goes on to write, a great counterbalance to the former book is The Positive Power of Negative Thinking. That's the title of the book, The Positive Power of Negative Thinking. As a former production manager, I completely endorse the book's thesis that pessimism has a vital role to play in our lives. You know, as a matter of fact, I remember in reading Seligman's book on authentic happiness, I believe he also reviews some of the positive aspects of pessimism, that there are some survival advantages to a certain amount of pessimism. Jeff goes on to say, in this book, the author champions what he calls, or what she calls, defensive pessimism. Unlike regular pessimism, which can be debilitating, defensive pessimism is an attitude that allows us to accurately assess the world around us and plan for success in the face of chaos. Like Wiseman in The Luck Factor, the author draws upon experimental data to illustrate her points. In one particular experiment, she discusses how self-described optimists felt that they were in control of a randomized flashing light and trigger apparatus. Pessimists, on the other hand, were quick to assess the fact that the flashing light stimulus was random. Interesting. She also provides case studies of many highly successful people that visualize disastrous outcomes in order to achieve excellent results. The author's name is Julie Norum. She holds a PhD and is an associate professor at Wellesley College. Yeah, I think she'd be a great guest too. He says, I believe these two books nicely illustrate two useful points on the spectrum of hope and expectation. At the end of show number 65, you noted, if I may paraphrase, the innate contradiction between the virtue of staying positive and the hazard of alienating the shadow. In response to that, I would like to quote from one of my favorite authors, Thaddeus Golis. In his book, The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment, Thaddeus states, quote, what does it mean to be whole? It means that we must be willing to conceive of, to contain within ourselves, whatever is other than any limited idea. It means knowing that when we emphasize a positive, we are at the same time creating a negative. When we choose an ideal of knowledge, then we must deal with the ignorance that is other than the knowledge. If we remain constantly open and unresisting to such negatives, we are not compelled to dwell on them. End quote. Given the above statement, I see some potential for keeping an open dialogue with the shadow while at the same time striving for that which is good. Thaddeus, incidentally, is a big hero of mine. He was a World War II vet that settled down in San Francisco, parentheses, your part of the world, close parens, to become a hippie. He wrote the very succinct Lazy Man's Guide, 80 half-size pages in all, to serve as a summary of his philosophy. It's perhaps the most influential book that I've ever read. I would recommend Thaddeus as a potential interviewee, but regrettably for us, he's moved on to a different corner of the cosmos. Well, Dr. Dave, These are some of the things that have come into mind in response to your recent shows. I would have been a bit more brief, but you mentioned that you were in the midst of drafting a possible course curriculum on positive psychology. I figured that the above books might therefore be of interest. Kindest regards, Jeff. They are indeed of interest, Jeff. Thanks so much. And your nice second missive here, as well as the other emails that I read today, just once again emphasizes what an intelligent and thoughtful audience I am blessed with. So with that, let me just remind you that you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can also leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod, or you're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that. There's a MyChingo logo on our Shrink Wrap Radio website, and you can also leave voicemail on our phone, which is 206-888-2746. Please help us grow our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. Thanks again to Rabbi Abner Weiss for the wonderful interview on Kabbalah. And as you heard, our next show will be about the psychology of jury consulting with Dr. Judy Palatinia. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.